This is Javon, creator and voice of Static Core. I'm really excited to announce that a lot of things are in the works for the story. We have a Facebook page and a website is being built, and now we have an illustrator. David Carmona is a talented young artist from Bogota, Colombia, and he is the first official collaborator on this project. His first illustration is amazing, and he's also available for hire. So if you have some illustration work that needs to be done, hit him up. You'll find a link on the Facebook page. David did an outstanding job making a 3D rendering of the giant wall at the heart of this first story, and we're already hard at work on the next illustration. My goal for this story has always been to make it interactive. So in the weeks to come, as Control-Alt-Delete wraps up, you'll start to see some shorter mini episodes that talk about content you'll be able to see on the website. It should be a lot of fun. If you're enjoying this story and want to support its success, please like the Facebook page, share it with a friend, post a link on your favorite nerd or sci-fi page so that people can listen to the podcast. I'd also love to hear from you. So shoot me a message on Facebook or by email, which of course you will find on the Facebook page under the same name as the show, Static Core. Peace out, Static Nation, and enjoy this new episode.
Blackburn, Unit 0, Digit 6, in my continued first-hand account of the CADR incident, the one that started the timestamp coded 001-000. I heard people call it the Cater incident. I hope that doesn't catch on. If there's too many nicknames for a mission, it just gets confusing. I would like to thank Internal Affairs for addressing my grievances. So far, every one of them has been affirmed as valid and sent for formal review and resolution by the Dictorate, our judicial branch, as it were. I hear the new school units think it's unfair the old guard is going to make the final decision about what's going to happen, but I've lost as many appeals as I've won over the years, and they've been responsible for supporting as many radical changes as they've resisted, so there's no guarantees. As much as I want to go back to the way things were before we went into the freezer, I recognize that changes have to be made, and parts of what the new school are doing is on point. In a few short years, Unit 2 Plus managed to kill more companies than we thought possible and embed the core more deeply into the cities than ever before. They must be doing something right. I wasn't there when 675 was woken up. I understand it was quite dramatic. Hugging, jumping up and down, all of which was short-lived as they were immediately debriefed and read into what was going on. All of the commanders and lieutenants for the Army of the Dead were in war rooms, conferring with Pharaoh and Monaco when word came that 675 wanted to see Pharaoh. He called for a one-hour recess, and his hologram vanished from where we were in Miami. From what I understand, he went to speak to his team. My unit got together for a quick check-in, those that were available anyway. At the time, we were spread out all over the region, mostly up to no good. As detonators, myself, Cam, and Cakes had the responsibility of building courier teams that would help us get to the locations where the grid rays would be lit up. This kind of squad has to have drivers who can handle any vehicle, assault and defensive specialists, programmers and engineers, usually a team of 6 to 8 people, with more added on depending on the nature of the mission. Like me, they all have to be volunteers, because if the detonator goes down, somebody else has to step up. It was easy to fill a few spots with people from my unit. DD had the clearance to keep rolling as my personal escort and didn't turn down the bump in pay for the extra hazard involved in transporting a G-Ray. She only had 2 requests. First, did I cover the cost for a new vehicle? And second, did she get to keep it afterwards? I said yes, and she disappeared to get to work. While we were building our detonator squads, the Stratosphere Central Communications Hub for the region came back online. Again, I'm providing my timestamp GPS location. This will show that I was in Port of Miami Bay and not in Atlanta when this facility was reactivated. I know that I'm on a short list of people who could have turned that system back on. And while on occasion I have been known to be in more than one place at a time, in this instance, I had nothing to do with whatever was going on at Site Zero and couldn't have brought the network back up. The Central Communications Hub is the digital information nexus that connects the region to the global stratosphere. While there are other ways to access the cooperative and CORE's cloud and networks, without the stratosphere, it's like trying to find a specific drop of water in an ocean. A lot of the problems we had coordinating our movements, getting support, running hacks, all the background work that makes missions run smooth, all of that is run through support services, which also rely on the Stratos. If you look at the top of your signal searcher right now, along the top of the screen, you'll see a list of small icons that are either lit up or ghosted out. Those are available services: base communications, mission control, tech support, backup, remote hacking, submission deployment, all manner of support to make the lives and work of people in the co-op and CORE easier. The first thing I did when the dice log came up was check to see who of the people in the region had the skills to be on our detonator squads. I also wanted to know how many people were checked in as part of the Army of the Dead. We got off the Ontario snow with about 700 people. By the time we got ready to go back on the water, there were 2,578 people in the region and another 4,000 running remote support, all waving the banner. A bit of housekeeping. Make sure you take the time to update or fill in your dice sheet with your qualifications, skills, and assets. It's how you'll get work when people are looking for support. Make sure you set a schedule as well. The last thing you want is to be getting pinged in your off hours. Also, if you were part of the CADR and haven't gotten a dice face for your sheet yet, make sure you register your activities. We're still recognizing the great work that was put in. Before the recess was over, I got the base spec requirements from Armadillo Armor. Basic specifications is what a builder or maker asks of you to complete an order. The request raised an eyebrow. If I ordered a suit, my base specs would be my measurements: height, neck, inseam. In a car would be preferred driving side, transmission type, pedal tension, etc. There are base specs for everything you use. Like I said before, you're pumping out all kinds of data that's being captured by your signal searcher. What stood out to me was that the base specs they wanted were specifically for athletic combat, gladiator games. I expected we would be using the grid lighting ceremony and its spectacle of games and events as a distraction to cover our getting on the island Sneaky Pete style. Pharaoh had other ideas. Dryce, Marzell, Lance, and Carol came into the room a few minutes before the recess was over. They took a few minutes to shake everyone's hand and say thank you. When the meeting got started and all the holograms beamed in from around the world, Marzell spoke for a couple minutes to say thank you to everyone else that helped. She tried to explain what happened and why they hadn't been able to make it out of Tardata's HQ, but before she could get more than a few words in, Monaco stood up and started clapping. We all joined her. They'd earned a round of applause, if not much more. All things aside, no one had ever gotten their hands on a grid map, and if not for them, we wouldn't have a chance at taking down the wall. More than that, they were, are, survivors. I don't know that anybody would have been able to last as long as they did in the core of a city, battling day and night for weeks on end. We finally got back to business. There was a long list of orders, missions, objectives, and tactics that needed to go live. The first order for me was no surprise. Myself and several others were to enter the Roman Games Team World Championship. We were also ordered to win. With the increased numbers, Pharaoh took things to a whole new level and called for actions across all three flexes. The orders didn't make sense on their own, but everyone was aware that Pharaoh was running a second level of missions that were completely covert. We just had to trust that things would come together. The last thing that happened was that Pharaoh requested Cam, Cakes, and I give him options for how to detonate the G-rays in such a way that they would take out all the islands and the wall. He called the meeting and asked for us to report to him in 30 minutes. Truth was, we had been thinking about it from the moment we saw those bombs. Our basic scheme was to weaken the foundations with one of the G-rays and to use the others to split the second flex in two, which would cause the third flex to collapse in on itself. It was nothing fancy, but the resulting shockwave would have blown the wall and everything else in the Gulf to bits. Pharaoh wanted something that was going to get the world's attention in a bigger way, though. As if flattening a city and several dozen islands wouldn't be enough. I've submitted a copy of my orders to detonate my G-ray on the space deck of the Orinara Tower, Golfiana's capital building. It was obvious from the detonation formatting requested that Pharaoh wanted to send the top of the spire into space. At the time, I assumed it was because the additional mass would have been too great, causing a larger collapse and tidal wave than he intended. This is another instance where I didn't ask questions that would complicate things. Pharaoh was very specific with where he wanted to send the top of the tower after the explosion, so I programmed accordingly. It is a sincere effort with our operations to avoid unnecessary collateral damage, even if it would hurt our enemies. I chalked his request up to that. It was hours after the detonation that I realized there was more to the parting shot than I realized. The next phase of operations focused on disrupting the standard operations of the major cities along the Gulf Coast, with an emphasis on making it look like standard business-to-business competition. With so many companies and other cities visiting the zone, it would be natural for there to be a lot of action. Chicago was in Houstallis. LA was in New Mexico City. Old Vancouver was in Texas. It was a veritable playground of allies and enemies. The last task for me before departing Miami was syncing the control ring for my G-Ray with the ones Cam and Cakes carried. Doing so set the programming and quantumly entangled the devices so that if any significant changes were made to one, the others would adjust accordingly. We also looped our static signatures so that we would have an increased awareness of what was happening with each other. Vitals, mission progress, operational status. At the moment, three green bomb icons with red circles appeared beside each of our names, and we were now shown as a special group inside our unit's heads-up display. The bomb icon itself represented the grid ray. The circle was the status of the space it was headed for, and its compliance with the specifications that we set for a successful detonation. Those red rings had to turn green before we could press go. We took a moment to clear our minds of the long list of things that had to be done to successfully take down that structure. And Cake started reciting something of a creed, which we joined her in. Now, forever, steadfast, loyal, we stand in the gap for the nameless, landless, and forgotten, till we die or our enemies fall. From there, we went in different directions. Cakes was headed to the first flex, straight into the teeth of the wall. Cam headed for one of the largest expanses in the second flex, the Hugh Stallus spaceport. I was headed for the sky. The popularity of trains is one of the things that still surprises me, given that they were relatively dead before the collapse, at least in America. However, considering their efficiency in moving people and goods at high speeds, it makes sense. Modern rail lines are 2.5 times wider than the old railways, and at speeds of well over 1,000 miles an hour, high-speed magnetic levitation is the primary way people and goods move over long distances, especially because it avoids the roving patches of bad space in the air. But more strategically, because the power it requires and the railroads themselves help to stabilize surrounding space and for cities to have more control over their regions. Train yards and railroads like ports are free trade zones, one of the few places we can tread with minimal risk of being gunned down. The port of Miami was chosen specifically for its location between the Atlantic coast and the South Florida rail yard. We had a spur line that linked right into the Ocean Gulf Railroad line, which, as the name implies, connects the Gulf of Mexico to the Atlantic Ocean, crisscrossing the state of Florida. I grabbed a barrel of grease and a cart of tools and headed for the garage, where the train engines were stored. When I got there, a team of digits was already at work, shaking down the locomotives. The well-oiled machinery of the static core was getting back up and running. Our relative anonymity in the city vanished when we had to clear the containers they had stacked in front of the security gate that blocked the entrance to our train yard. I wasn't surprised. When we first opened Palm Bay, different companies used to make a game of blocking our line into the train yard with equipment, containers, or by moving their lines to cut ours off. They assumed we were green, upstarts they could mess with. We made a game of warping their rails, dismantling forklifts, welding stacks of shipping containers together, and gluing their locomotives to the track. You'd be amazed at how powerful modern adhesives can be. After a while, they got the message and left our stuff alone. At 700 miles an hour, the trip across Florida to West Miami took no time at all. Just like when we left Bermuda, we were one of several stops the train would make on its way to Atlanta, dropping off people and equipment. About 50 of us transferred to boats at West Miami's intermodal station. We noted some heavy digital assaults against the shell companies we used to access ports and had to take some time to get on computers to fight them off. And a heavy private security presence with the companies that saw us at the train yard when we left, at all of their loading and unloading stations at the West Miami port, armed guards lined the waterways, all very intentionally watching us. It was enough to give us pause. But luckily, they were just there for show, and we were able to get underway without incident. Getting out to see the gleaming light of the coast cut through the late afternoon sky like a knife. Seeing daylight bend into the shadow of the digital field always reminds me of the people living in darkness at the lower levels of the cities. After the sun went down, several of us were sitting on the deck of the Osprey as the countdown to Gulfiana's grid lighting hit zero. Our eyes were trained to a point in the sky where we knew the Orinara Tower was. The pale blue dot blinked on moments after the countdown finished. When standing on the deck of the ship, we all just had to be in amazement for a moment. When the countdown finished, it was trading that started, and all that trading is what actually powered the city up. a grid lighting isn't just turning the lights on. The lights come on because business is getting done. All the data related to Gulfiana flows through the city's central server. The more data, the more power is needed, and the more it pulls, and thus the lights go up. Usually cities come online in phases, slowly integrating into a zone. Moreover, it can take decades to get beyond Category 3.5, if they ever do so. The method of jump-starting a whole region by pushing its anchor city straight to Category 5 was something new. Had it been successful, it would have been a seismic shift in city building and expansion tactics. Pulling down so much power so fast would allow Tardata to reshape even badly broken space with ease. They had already started selling war bonds and had plans to move against SOAMCONA, the South American Continental Alliance. Looking at a live map of the region, we started seeing lights for many of the smaller cities going dim or shutting down completely. Some of the places that went dark knew their end was coming and were emptied. Others were caught off guard because they didn't make the right alliances or were afterthoughts for Tardata. Versal and everyone else looking to cash in on this new archipelago in the Gulf. A powered down city is one of the scariest places to be. Not only is it lawless, parts of the city can collapse at any given moment. Special commendations have been issued to the digits and units who went into those cities to save people who had been left behind. In those couple hours, staring out over the ocean while doing the pre-game work, the glow of the new city grew brighter on the horizon. The shining lights of digital field towers on the island speckled across the Gulf increased in number as more companies and more people bought into the new region. Using a shell company, we got in on the action, buying one of the premium medium-sized islands in the Central Bay. It had private ocean access via a personal canal and a road into the Gulfiana city center. The deed and the master key for the property both have timestamps from when they were purchased and have been turned over to the Internal Affairs Division. This should serve as further proof to refute the claim from Unit 2 Plus Alpha that we brokered a deal with Versal Services for access to Gulfiana. As soon as we locked in our location, we sent it out to the CBs, the division that gets our facilities in place. There were dozens of units on the water just like us, waiting to know where they would dock. Long convoys of barges carrying building materials and even whole buildings had been moving to the islands for months. But we could see the distinct difference in the stuff that was time to show up after the city was live. Overhead, the blinking lights of hover choppers packed the sky lanes in increasing numbers as they came from on land, bringing more people and materials. Never missing an opportunity to run infection protocol, particularly on easy access targets, 10 of us on the Osprey got dressed for stealth as Captain Didi sailed us right up to the side of one of the barges carrying buildings with Tardata City of Gulfiana logos on them. Using gecko gloves and boots allowed us to scale the smooth 40-foot side of the barge with no problem. A quick scan for security bots on the deck allowed us to sneak on between shifts. There were no people on board these ships, but there were plenty of private guards hovering overhead in the hoppers, waiting to drop down at the first sign of an intruder. It was risky to run infiltration during this time because if we had been caught and accurately identified, it would have put the city on a whole different security footing. We knew the likelihood that those buildings would ever get placed before the city was leveled was low, but it didn't change our MO. Plus, our main goal was to infiltrate Gulfiana's digital network. These buildings were a great soft point. Even without being hardwired onto the grid and only partially powered, those structures were still part of Tardata's cloud. Thanks to the serial numbers I skimmed earlier from Tardata HQ and clones of the property and hardware keys we got from Unit 675, we were able to access the buildings and with relative ease. We snuck into a communications relay hub, believing correctly it would be linked to both the city's and Tardata's central systems, as well as the backup and emergency redundant systems. The only problem we ran into was when we got to the 13th floor of the building and discovered it was furnished by Syngas Systems. First, the 13th floor isn't really floor number 13. It's the physical plan. Highly restricted access, extra security, you know the routine. Second, of the many unique features of Syngas Systems, one I dislike the most is that they require operating in a specialized atmosphere. We don't understand all the physics or engineering of how Syngas Systems work, and we make it a point not to mess with them on a whim. If it hadn't been for the facility and hardware keys, we would have totally been screwed. Being partially screwed meant we ended up having to fight off spider bots. It is simply not a fair fight to battle against something with eight limbs. But that is the point of their design. Syngas Systems has an unusual ability to accurately detect everything, including static signatures. Gunfire was an option of last resort because it would have triggered that higher security response. One of the hardest things to do is to let yourself get choked out so someone can come in and save you. I didn't know 3850 personally, but he's a hell of a tactical brawler. Fighting 6-foot-tall spider bots is at least a 2-person job. Their AI is smart enough to fight off teams of people. It takes special tactics to break one down. I was blocking more hits than I was landing while trying to crack it with my collapsible baton. Sometimes, slower is faster. Instead of trying to outpace the machine, we took turns pushing and pulling it, kicking it high and then low, all to mix up the kinds of attacks it had to respond to. You can't beat a machine at its own game. The methodical application of rapidly learned patterns and the ability to sense and respond faster than biological systems would allow, the trick is to be more fluid. The unknown digit that jumped in to save me knew the standard combat forms and progressions for the situation we were in and saw that I was using them too. After a few exchanges where me and 3850 kept the spider bot between us, we started moving around it. I went counterclockwise while he went clockwise. Stepping over and moving through each other's blocks and strikes, we moved in what seemed like perfect choreography. We had to keep the machine busy till the code runners could hijack a couple of the regular security droids and send them up a signal that they had secured the intruders. Finally, seeing the droid, we both let the spider bot knock us to the ground and rolled out of the way so the two machines could signal each other. Finally, clear of the machines, it was easy to find the servers. Someone had to physically hack into them so the digital team at Mission Control could get to the back door access to the rest of Golfiana and Tardata's systems. This was the point when I got the sense that the work was stacking up. With the master keys from 675, the serial numbers I got from Tardata HQ, Law's orders took him to the construction staging site and the shipping yards and was able to upload a detailed registry of everything on and en route to the islands. Our knowledge and ability to infiltrate was increasing rapidly. And it would all come to bear as we went forward. All the increased information and access allowed us to get a clearer image of what was happening on the island, and to develop a detailed map. The core of the island was dominated by a massive city structure that contained all of the second flex that was built at that point. It was 30 stories high and 40 square city blocks. Centered atop the massive complex was the Championship Arena. It was surrounded by a number of skyscrapers and one skybreaker. The Orinara Tower, City Hall. The Gladiator Games took place in the Championship Arena, which was one of many fields of play that was in full swing that night, as you can see from all the trophies the Static Nation brought home. As has been the case since the days of the Roman Empire, the circus still is the greatest distraction for the people and the fastest way to make a buck. Races on land, sea, and air, fight sports, casinos, live stream stars, bars, clubs, games, old and new, all were played. No fewer than 4 interstellar championships were decided that night. But there were many niche competitions run as well, the most popular of which are hunting games. The variety of prey in these games is expansive. Wild animals, scarce as they are, engineered biologicals, droids and cyborgs, and of course, people. All attempts to ban human hunting competitions have failed, so like everything else inhumane, they think the best way to check it is to profit from it. No one wants to see a weakling slaughtered. The hunted are as likely to win as the hunter. It is high sport. So the winning argument went. I started gathering intel on what gladiator games were being played, what companies were vying to get their teams in, and what players were known to be headed or already in Golfiana. Unlike the days of my youth, where a fixed team would play for a season, and at the end the 2 best teams would face off, now it's all about buying in, bidding for players, and negotiating the rules of a game before it's played. Now, a team's roster changes every game. Sometimes games and even championships are decided without the game ever being played because they award points based on all the pre-game action. The Brawl Ball Championship was won by Syngas 2 years in a row because they managed to put up 75 points in the pregame before the ball even dropped. The game itself was no more than an exhibition by fourth-rate stand-ins and bots. The saddest part is that people on the roof still sell tickets for the game and take bets from all the people in the attic and the floor. As we approached the main cluster of islands, I was glad that we had a private canal. The other waterways were so packed with ships and yachts that people disembarked for speedboats. When we docked, there was no time to marvel at what was going on around us. There were submarines from both Blade and Cannon and the Bank of Dead Trust. Myself and many others needed to make withdrawals so we could take care of business. One of the challenges we have in dealing on grid is that we don't use banks that are publicly listed on the World Economic Band. So, outside of frozen cryptocurrency, we have to trade in hard assets. Toting around a 3.5-foot-long, 200-pound case full of rare and precious materials is a lot harder than dealing with a briefcase of currency cards, but it gives us the advantage of being able to deal in assets that are more sought after than money. And before I propagate any myths about my or anyone else's superhuman strength in carrying around that much weight, the jacket I wore came with the case. In addition to bulletproofing, it also had strength augmenting elements in the skeleton to make hauling that much weight a lot easier. While being flashy has its place, so does being understated. We dressed in Vanta black. I'm talking suits, ties, shirts, socks. In the light-absorbing materials, we look like moving shadows. Between us, we carried assets worth $500 billion, $150 billion of which was to buy the 5-acre island. The rest was fun money. By now, you know we had layers of security. City openings are notorious times for hostile takeovers. The Army of the Dead repelled 7 such attempts to take our island in the brief time Gophiana existed. My G-Ray was locked in the Blading Cannon submarine. The rest of my courier team hadn't arrived yet. Myself, Monaco, Rude, and Carol had to go complete the real estate deal for the island. We also had orders to cause economic chaos, and the fastest way to do that was by ruining the real estate deals that were going on. Piling into a large SUV with our cases in the back, Dee Dee drove us to the city center. We rode with straps in our lap, knowing that at any moment things could go sideways. We had 6 digits rolling in our security convoy and even hired 20 dark guards as an additional layer of protection. You can use your enemy to your benefit, especially when it makes you look less conspicuous. In the brief drive from the island to the city center, the naked carnage of the capitalist feeding frenzy was on full display. We passed a flesh market where synthetic humanoids and genetically engineered creatures were sold right next to non-citizens. I saw people running for their lives and others dead on the street. By our count, there were several dozen murders between citizens and non-citizens. Some were killed for nothing but a cheap thrill. Others were just on the short end of the stick in a business deal gone wrong. Others came up lucky in their effort to climb the corporate ladder. Using the executive road, it spiraled around the main city complex, giving us a view of the second flex. The soft blue and white lights of the buildings were broken up by the shimmering streams of the canals that were supposed to be the signature feature of Gophiana. Arriving at the top of the second flex and winding into the cluster of towers, each was a marvel of modern engineering, all of it built on bricks held together by the dead. The property management office was as jumping as any club. They had reporters on the scene talking to company bigwigs about their acquisitions and plans in Gophiana. I've gotten a few laughs playing back the interviews and hearing what they wanted to build and how much they had already spent. Sitting in the driveway, we took quick stock of who was inside. Quantum Fiscality Profiteers, or QFP, was Gophiana's financier and city banker. I'd have to make a huge special entry to detail the history of conflict with the Nasbanologies conglomeration because it goes far beyond the economic warfare and into the deeply personal. We also needed updated grid faces, another service that was available with the Stratosphere Regional Hub backup. While manually tuning your digital field projection can allow for more nuance in the moment, with more eyes than could be counted checking your identity on a hot patch of grid, it's better to trust the AI and professionals running it to build a digital profile that can stand up to the high levels of security scrutiny. Before sending a notice, we double-checked it all. We flagged the media to let them know that there were some big wigs walking into the building. Some of the island buyers were there. This allowed us to confirm that everything we had put together was working. Never walk onto a grid if you aren't sure your profile is airtight. We were relatively late in the game at this point, even though it had been less than 2 hours since the lights went on. All of the major players and big deals happened within seconds of the city opening. Part of what made the Orinara Tower light turn on also made sure that the business was moving fast and dirty. Whatever business they had was completed so they could get on to their grand openings, parties, and games. The 4 of us fell in between the lines of dark guards and static corpsmen to stroll through the grand concourse of City Hall. The entire building was laid in pale blue glass, white marble, and inlaid with silver and gold. In the cities, at these high levels of the second flex, and even more so in the third, if it looks like gold, it is solid gold or silver. Generally mined from space or bent from other materials, the excessive opulence is a cultural thing for city builders. Diamond encrusted light fixtures, platinum door frames, deep green emeralds, and blood red rubies in the up and down elevator indicators. Every time I walk into a building like that, I want to melt it down to scrap. The most dangerous part of this step of the mission wasn't walking around with billions of dollars or having to deal with people that would kill us on sight if they knew who we were. I hate transiting grid flexes on the digital field. Not because it's extremely painful, at least for me, but because sometimes my body doesn't respond well, and if that happens, it could mean being left exposed and incapacitated. The third flex is very tall compared to the other two, and the level we were on was at the very bottom. High-flying CDs, that's city dwellers, who never leave the sky or live in space, consider it a mixing zone to be this close to the second flex. It's not far enough away for them. We had to leave most of our security escort behind. Only two of our security people were allowed to come up with us. Standard protocol in a restricted fire zone. When we entered the elevators to the upper levels of City Hall, they did give our security coordinator limited access to the grid so they could monitor us, and we, of course, used that access to infiltrate their systems even further. This was the third point of attack that ultimately allowed us to fully compromise their systems. The access we got from the 13th floor and having the backdoor codes via the serial numbers from the communications hardware being the other two. Special thanks to Unit 38, aka Blind Eyes. They took all that data and access and used it to run a brutal data war that was as responsible for this win as anything on the ground. We were sizing up the place for a moment before we walked in. Of course, feeding our observations and scans back to Mission Control to fill in the map, and identifying people so we could start tracking targets. The first thing I noticed when I came out of the freezer was how much taller people were on average. I used to be 5'8 most days. I'm an even 6 feet tall now. With genetic engineering and augmentations, 6'6 is the average for people in the sky, and 9 feet tall isn't uncommon. While waiting in the lobby of the property office, we played a game that we came up with years ago where we looked for all the matching details. The staff all wore the same outfits. They matched the building. The cocktail glasses matched the building. The QFP and Golfiana logo, tied together with the Tardata logo, was embossed and stitched into everything. It was even finely pressed into the tiles and woven into the carpet. It was even engraved into the thin metal bead around the edge of the plate glass walls. What few employees we saw wore suits that were also in the same color scheme. They all had the same shoes, and even their eye color was all turned to that pale Golfiana blue. That was a new touch. The transaction itself was fairly simple. They called us into the property appraiser's office where Rothschild Burnesca was waiting. We submitted our digital deed, turned over the payment, and he issued the command key for the property. Monaco handed the transaction by paying with a block of antimatter suspended in a 6-inch diamond brick. We sidestepped the meaningless banter with Burnesca and decided to forego the meetings with the city's pre-approved architects and vendors. We did accept the invitation to the trading floor, where we could bargain for more real estate and other lucrative opportunities. Some of the people that bought into Golfiana only did so as an investment so they could flip the property. Others sold their shirt to get a whatever square footage they could, and we were looking for others and were looking for others to buy in to their development. Ultimately, though, it came down to who the city wants to do business with and how much money they can make. We paid the premium markup, allowing us to set up some advantageous partnerships and put us in a great position to bargain without being descended upon like prey animals by the vultures. If they had known we were the predators, they would have handled things differently. These kinds of business dealings are as much ceremony as substance. Practically speaking, everything that happens in the trading room could be done remotely, but the free dealing process is like poker and chess. Traders use their assets like game pieces, but they can lie about them to an extent. They may be gambling with an ally's money, using a valued relationship as a bargaining chip, or betting on being able to take over a rival's business to increase their holdings. Things always get interesting when the trading reaches an impasse and they have to be decided by a game of chance. The trading room in the Yorinara Tower was gorgeous. It was suspended out the back of the building, overlooking the arena, which could be seen through the crystal floor. The polished gold and silver beams gleamed under the brilliant gem-encrusted chandeliers. With the city lights twinkling below, it looked like walking on stars. There was a balcony with chairs and observation areas that overlooked the trading tables, about 24 of which were spread across the floor. There are very specific parameters for the sizes and functions of the tables and how many sides they have. Octagons are the worst because with anywhere from 8 to 16 people, there are too many ways for things to go wrong. The tables themselves are synced directly to the World Economic Band and provide details and feedback for anything placed on them and who's sitting at them. Personal details and net worth estimates, materials authentication or currency validation, real-time market values, document credentialing. If contracts were being struck, it would be easy for someone to claim they're carrying $1 million block of frozen cryptocurrency or tritium plasma, but once you put your assets on the line, the table reveals all. We split up so we could wreck more tables. Keeping our silent chat active in our HUDs, we were able to hear each other without speaking a word. We also started marking persons of interest, city commissioners, CEOs, execs, dark undercovers, and private security personnel. Never sit at a table you can't deal or shoot your way out of, and never deal with anyone you can't escape without killing, unless you're ready to go that route. Simple rules to avoid throwing your life away while free dealing. Mission Control picked a table for me to bargain on based on who was sitting there and what they were bargaining for. While property was the main dish, almost anything could be served up. Service contracts, construction and development rights, roads, waste disposal, and of course, security. Mission Con also fed me information in real time about the alliances, assets, and weaknesses of each of my opponents. I almost got knocked over by someone that just lost their shirt when they stormed away from the table I was headed for. I sat down across from Mr. Landite Rockshark, security commissioner for Miami Tardata Tech, Hyvex Stone Snake, and Reynold Marble Hawk were to my left and right. If you're thinking those names were weird, you're right. It's a city dweller thing for people to have in alliances to adopt similar names. They had already cleaned out 4 people and looked at me like I was going to be the 5th. The surface of the tables are mechanized, with small trap doors and trays that carry away the cash and cards. Icy green blocks of frozen crypto and shimmering trinkets offered up, and all of them get stored beneath the glass of the table where the winner can see their spoils. Samuel Smithson is one of my many aliases. That's the name that popped up when I sat down at the table. Net worth, $17.5 billion, and a list of companies owned as long as my arm. The Sovereign Corporation Joint Chamber mandates that upon opening, cities must have free market windows when all buyers can get a piece of the action. Sometimes whole cities are lost by the companies that founded them during this process. It's a high-risk, high-reward system. The first few moments are all about sizing up your opponent and positioning your assets. It's not as simple as the person with the most money or the biggest company wins. There are several dozen categories of businesses and assets, and the goal is to build a dominant position based on the formation of your assets as compared to the other bargainers. As always with these people, there are rules for the rules, and loopholes for the rules. But the basic idea is that if you can afford to sit at the table, you can win it. The it in this case was a 50-acre site that was already home to a transit corridor between mainland Gulfiana and the ring of islands that surrounded it. I played with one intention: to break down the alliance between Hyvec, Reynolds, and Landite. The first two rounds were fairly standard, just stacking up cash blocks, or in my case, actual cash. I love to break out the stacks of $10,000 U.S. notes with Ruth Bader Ginsburg on them. They always get strange looks when the table lights up and verifies their authenticity. Once it was established that I couldn't be scared off or bought out, they started stacking up material assets. Precious metals, rare and exotic chemical compounds, natural resources they held by the ton, all represented by cards with different icons. I let them go at this for a couple rounds, passing my turn until it came time for me to show or quit. I dropped a 6-inch block on the table. The set of 4 solid gold cubes were suspended in a vacuum case with a sustained electric spark running between them, representing 4 tons of electrolyzed gold, a precious commodity in the manufacture of nanoelectronics. I've been through many of these bargaining sessions, and I marvel at the fact that modern economics is at some moments reduced to a tabletop game. Things didn't get interesting until it came time to start trading companies. Even with just a few thousand digits active in the region, we were able to get a lot done. In the hour it took to get through the first couple rounds on the trading room floor, the Static Corps worked to seize control of companies held by Hyvec, Landite, and Reynolds. Some of that was just by buying up stock. There were some physical seizures as well, and in several cases, it was a matter of making the controlling, of taking the controlling share or rights of a third party that one of them was partnered with. It was very technical, but the ultimate result is that the cards, slabs, and blocks they had thrown on the table began to blink out or degrade in value. The plays we ran against them were sophisticated. It wasn't about taking them all down at once. We made it look like they were attacking each other or were under assault from various allies. It didn't take long for them to turn on each other and forget I was even at the table. The collapse of the alliance between Rock Shark, Marble Hawk, and Stone Snake had a cascade effect throughout the room. First, the table I was at shattered. The deafening crack cut through the noise of the room, and moments later it happened again and again and again. All but 2 of the tables busted. Never had so many trading tables shattered at one time. Before anyone could react, the fighting started. To be clear, this was not a fight to the death. This was settlement by fisticuffs. Under the circumstances, traditional dealing for the properties at play was suspended, and cash or equivalents on the table went up for grabs. Before they started swinging on each other or me, I decked Hyvac, Landite, and Reynolds with a combo of face shots that gave me a chance to get away from the table and square up the room before I got hit from behind. A good number of people just backed away, heading to the edge of the room where they could observe. They were willing to lose whatever money they had in the games. Settling like this is scored like an MMA fight. More gamification. Everyone's name and points appeared on the walls in either green or red, depending on whether they were winning or losing one of the available pots of money. There can only be one winner for each table, so it's no harm, no foul when allies turn on each other. It was obvious to everyone in the trading room that everything was thrown into chaos by Rock Shark and his guys, so they got stomped on immediately, and the rest of gold. To be clear, this was not a fight to the death. This was settlement by fisticuffs. Under the circumstances, dealing for the properties at play was suspended, and cash or equivalents on the table went up for grabs. Before they started swinging on each other or me, I decked Hyvac, Landite, and Reynolds with a combo of face shots that gave me a chance to get away from the table and square up the room before I got hit from behind. A good number of people just backed away, heading to the edge of the room where they could observe. They were willing to lose whatever money they had in the games, rather than get beat down. Settling like this is scored like an MMA fight, more gamification. Everyone's name and points appeared on the walls in either green or red, depending on whether they were winning or losing one of the available pots of money made available from the tables. There can only be one winner for each table, so it's no harm, no foul when allies turn on each other. It was obvious to everyone that was trading that everything got thrown into chaos by Rock Shark and his guys, so they got stomped on immediately by the rest of the Gulfiana commissioners and partners. Before anyone could turn on me, I went on the attack. Running at full speed, I slammed into someone with a shoulder tackle square to the waist, folded them in half, and scooped him up before tossing him to the ground. Being shorter than most of the people I fight, I've learned a couple of things. I took a couple of steps and used a chair to launch myself into a flying elbow, which connected with somebody's face. I heard their teeth rattle like dice as they tumbled across the floor. From there, I went into a groundwork, snatching people by the leg, twisting ankles and knees till they popped. I heard the ligaments in their joints snap loose. I didn't get out of that mosh pit clean. I took some shots to the head. Someone grabbed me from behind, put me in a choke hold, and slung me to the ground before stomping me till my ribs started cracking. If not for the layers in my suit, I probably would have ended up with a collapsed lung. I got from under that butt whooping by grabbing the guy's foot and snapping his ankle 90 degrees. I've learned that slapping people in a fight is a particularly effective method for confusing them. People prepare for the hard, blunt force of a punch, but the glancing blow of a slap is disorienting and can help you move your opponent around and open up their defenses. The next person that swung on me got the back of my right hand, followed by a quick left palm to the face, which sent them stammering back and wide open for shots to the jaw that followed. Rude was in the thick of the brawl. At 6'6", he was able to mix it up with the big boys, so he busted heads. His long, lanky arms and cinder block-sized fists snapped like whips, cracking off jabs before delivering haymakers. His judo, masterful. And he took advantage of every step and misstep to level people with brutal throws that sent them flying over tables and into one another. I went back to watch the video to study Rude's tactics, because something you can't really appreciate are the disjointing moves he used to dislocate ribs, vertebrae, and collarbones. It looked like he was just hitting or snatching them around, but his strikes were crippling, something that would have consequences later. Monaco and Carol stood atop a table at the center of the room, kicking and punching people in the head. They made an extra effort to look out for each other since they were on the smaller side at 5'3 and 5'5. They tag-teamed on a few people. One of them would grab a guy holding his arm up while the other would bust them in the shoulder or elbow. They also made use of a good number of chairs to clobber people with. Contrary to the movies, when you hit someone with a chair, it doesn't shatter to pieces. Maybe they just make chairs better these days. But I can't believe they weren't being hit hard enough for them to break. When all was said and done, we walked out of the bargaining process with a couple hundred million more than we risked. The real estate plans for Golfiana were in complete disarray, and our profits just hit more prestigious level, having mashed on and knocked out some of the most elite people in the region. Most of the violence on the bargaining room floor wasn't random. We had a goal to hurt people who were going to be in the arena battles that came later that night. While the injuries would be easy enough to patch up by any doctor, for these people, not just any doctor would do. It was a good night to be in the high-end medical business.